Today's episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello, this is Eleanor Hyde, executive producer of Unwell. Welcome! I am excited. Jeffrey and I have gotten together here just after New Year's to answer a bunch of questions from our listeners. We collected a bunch of these questions. We're going to go through some of them and share some of the behind the scenes of how this show comes together. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Eleanor.
Havelock asks, what was your favorite episode to work on this season?
And again, that's season four.
Season four.
Can I remember that far back?
So one of my favorite episodes this season was season four, episode eight, which is the episode where Rudy, Nora, and Abby all climb the mountain.
Oh, yeah.
That was a delightful episode to work on for a number of reasons. And there is our new kitten, Fanwee, saying hi.
There's going to be a lot of meows in the background of this. She's really wants to be part of the fun.
She is very excited. Anyway, episode eight was a lot of fun for a number of reasons. I both directed and sound designed that episode. And so it's a really fun episode just in terms of like a three-hander with everyone playing off of each other. And there's a lot of really interesting dynamics there. The other really exciting thing was that I got to write the star music that happens in kind of the end, towards the end of the episode. And I don't have all of that many opportunities to compose for audio fiction. And that was a piece that I built using my modular synthesizer, and it was just a joy. It was a lot of fun.
I think I'm having trouble answering this question because the process of writing season four was we did it 1.5 times, mm-hmm. which I think is a story worth sharing.
Sure.
We wrote season four during the pandemic, and I want to say, we probably started writing it in like January or February of 21. And then, you know, we usually try to write the whole season over the course of like 4 or 5 months, which means that I don't know about the rest of you, but that is the time that I will remember as like the deepest, darkest pandemic, but like, you know, in the 6 months leading up to getting vaccinated. So it was a tough time. And I think as a writing team, that was very much reflected in that first draft of season four. And we all looked at season four and then sort of like collectively agreed like, oh, this really needs major changes. We probably rewrote a significantly 50% of it.
Yeah.
I would say changed. So one of the episodes that I remember really fondly is the Crafternoon episode, because that is an episode that changed just dramatically between the first draft and the second draft. That in the first draft, there was a Crafternoon.
Yeah, we got to go to the Crafternoon.
And everybody went to the Crafternoon, and there was, you know, conflicts that popped up because some of the town felt that, you know, the right way to handle all the wolves in town was just soldier on and do the thing. And some of the town was like, no, this is dangerous. We shouldn't be doing this. And
the wolves as pandemic was text rather than subtext.
Yeah, it was pretty right on the nose. And Rudy in particular in that episode had a very strong reaction to all of what was going on, and we felt like that needed to be reined in so that he could have a longer arc over the course of the season, blah, 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 lots of things. And yet there's something essentially about the idea of the Crafternoon and like the role it plays in the community that stays from that first draft to the second draft, and the way in which like it kind of places something in the town that I really enjoy and appreciate. So yeah, that's one of the episodes in the season that I have a lot of fondness for because of that.
I'm trying to think, we kind of have a signature event. Do we have one every season?
Yeah.
Season one, we have both the pageant and the Celery Festival.
We have Halloween.
Halloween in season three.
No, that's season two.
Oh, that's season two.
Yeah. Halloween is season because it goes summer, fall, winter, spring.
Right. That's right.
Right. So the summer is the Celery Fest. Fall is the is Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Winter, we don't. We did a Christmas episode instead, yeah. And which is like not a town event, but it.
But yes, feels similar.
We treated it a little bit like that, and the New Year's episode, I remember treating sort of similarly.
Yeah.
And then the spring one is the Crafternoon.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you for that question.
Yami Kaku asked us, was five seasons always planned? And the short answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think at the very, very beginning, this was in part because we felt like it was better to just have a plan for how long it was going to be so that we could make a plan for that. And also because then you're not asking people to commit to a project for their entire lives, even if 5 years is a long time. but as it went on, I would say like by the time we were writing season two, it felt like a pretty strong choice to be like, nope, this is the right amount of storytelling to tell this story.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I really love stories that know how long they're going to be and very deliberately walk through their arcs in that way. And I think planning out the five seasons from the beginning let us very deliberately make choices of how much we were going to reveal each season, etc.
Glenn asked us, compared to your original vision for the show, characters and plot lines, what is the biggest diversion that has occurred over time, and why did those altered plans happen?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I mean, the big kind of obvious one to talk about is the pandemic. Like, that happened in the middle of our writing season three. And I think we all learned a ton and changed a ton over those couple years. And I think there is a lot in the fabric of Unwell, even stuff that doesn't respond directly to the pandemic, that is very different because we're all very different people from when we started.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think having written season five, so like, you know, for Jeffrey and I answering these questions, like we now have the whole story in our heads and in our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And
in fact, having recorded all of season five, so it's like it has all been, we know how it all sounds.
It's on tape. It's in the can, as they say. I now would say that Unwell is a story about grief. And I don't think I knew that until the end. Like, I think for me, that's probably like the biggest shift is that at the beginning, if you'd asked me what the show was about, I would have said it's about family and it's about memory and it's about place. And all those things are still true. But ultimately, like as we've gotten closer, as we've gotten towards the ending, and as my relationship to the show has changed, like that core question of like, what is the story about has really shifted.
Yeah.
And I mean, that has a lot to do with the way the last couple of years have gone for, you know, us externally. So
yeah,
that's
yeah.
like that, that says that, you know, that's connected to your point about the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think if I have a like cuter answer, like, I think Chester's storyline is one that has surprised me. Mm-hmm. From the very beginning, it was important to me that Chester was an antagonist who deeply believed he was right. And that you as a listener could sort of be like, oh, no, I understand where he's coming from. Like, I remember really early on, we put all the characters in Hogwarts houses.
Uh-huh.
And we said that Chester was a Gryffindor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Chester is a person who believes this is the right thing, even if we as an audience think he is very wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And as time has gone on, the sort of like nuance of Chester and the way that he has like become more and more integral to the plot and the sort of like arc of how we find a common ground in mm-hmm. this town has been really surprising to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think a big piece of that is figuring out partway through that Chester was a father.
Oh, yeah. That unlocked something really interesting.
Yeah. And I think that having that like deep connection with him, and, you know, 2 out of 4 of our writers are parents, and letting Chester be kind of a place to engage with ideas about parenthood was really important.
Yeah, I would agree. This is a question from Caroline. Hi, everyone. The concept of watering the stones weaves all through the Unwell stories. Have the writers taken cues from the spiritual legacy of Native Americans and their use of stone fetishes and stone spirits? And do the prominent role of wolves in the story also refer to Native American wolf mythology? Thanks.
That's a really interesting question.
That's a really interesting question.
And I'm going to say no. That's actually not where that comes from or really tied to this story at all. And there's actually a really, really important reason behind that. When we kicked off Unwell, we talked a lot about how we wanted to tell a story that kind of engages with the past. And when you do a story like that in America, you are going to have to reckon with and think about colonization, indigenous people, the enslavement of Black people in this country, a huge number of things. But there is a tendency when and Eleanor and I are both white Americans, when people like us are telling stories that involve indigenous American people, there's a tendency to mythologize and to, you know, have this trope of the magical Native person. And we really wanted to avoid that. And so, yeah, no, we wanted to tell a story that wasn't appropriating or kind of exploiting anything like that. That was really important to us.
So that's not to say that like we couldn't have done it by mistake,
mm-hmm.
right?
Like, yes, absolutely.
I want to own that like storytellers do sometimes weave things into their stories without noticing it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an element to the way the mythology of Unwell is built that all of the things that are happening in the town, all of the sort of vocabulary, the myths, the why is it wolves that show up as opposed to something else, they are all in some way coming from or in response to the people who currently live there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying that in kind of a vague way because I'm trying not to like tip too much of our hand here. But that has been a guidepost that we have tried to use to not fall into that trap of pulling on what are essentially stereotypes to like create a sense of mythology. That everyone carries with them a set of, you know, things that scare them and things that they believe about how the world works and ways that they talk about, you know, God or the universe or the world or what have you. And that it is those mythologies, those things that people carry with them into Mount Absalom that the weird things that are happening in the town are all pulling from that. I don't know. I feel like I'm walking right on this line. And I can't decide if I've like said too much or too little.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's tough because I think it's a really fair question to ask of us. And it's one that we have asked internally over and over again, because we've also wrestled really hard with the idea of like when you tell a gothic story, one of the inherent pieces of a gothic story is that they're stories about place. And so when you wrestle with place, you at some point have to make a decision about when did history start? And one of the biggest pitfalls of American storytelling about this stuff is the idea that the history started when white people showed up. And so I think it's something we have consistently struggled with how to navigate in a way that is both acknowledging of the fact that the history of Mount Absalom starts far, far before the arrival of white settlers. And also, we don't want to tell an Indian burial ground story.
Yeah.
Like, we don't want to be telling a story that is like, oh, you built your town on an Indian burial ground, and that's why all these things are happening. Like, that is very much not the story we wanted to tell. And that, ultimately, I think Unwell is in part a story about the tension between those two ideas.
Sure.
That, like, sure. We as storytellers and as white folks trying to figure out how to talk about our place in this country are like looking at both those things and going, okay, this is hard. Let's see what happens. But yeah, the short answer is no.
Yeah.
We tried really hard actually not to kind of go to Native American folklore and mythology and go, great, we'll use some of that.
Yeah.
We tried really hard to not do that.
We'll use that as our supernatural base. I also want to say, and I feel like this is kind of in relation to this question, I want to talk about one of the places where I feel like we fell down a little bit, and let me make that more specific, where I fell down in how I was thinking about this story in relation to Indigenous people in America. I think it's really notable that, you know, we work very hard to be really respectful and not fall into the tropes of burial grounds and magic Native peoples and things like that. But what we did end up with is a story where the Indigenous Americans are all in the past. It is all past tense. And during the process of Unwell, a thing that has been pointed out to me by people who I have talked to about the story, friends who are from Indigenous communities have said, yeah, like this is just perpetuating the kind of the trope of Indigenous people don't exist anymore. And that's something that would require, you know, starting over from season one, but something that I'd like to fix next time.
We keep getting better at it.
Yep.
We hope.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Our next question is from Sarah. If at least three people know that Dot didn't water the stones, why don't they go water the dang stones? All caps. Thank
Great
you, Sarah.
Great question, Sarah. Yeah. That's a great question. Somebody should probably just do it, and then there wouldn't be a story. Nothing would have ever happened. It wouldn't have been a big deal. No. I think maybe a more fair answer to this question, though, is that there is an implication early in the story that no one really understands why this is important.
Mm-hmm.
That the idea that this is actually of significance is sort of lost on everyone.
Well, and we do hear a couple of times sprinkled through the story, times where people have continued to water the stones, but there's also an implication of, like, it was missed enough that it's too bad.
Oh, yeah. And I love the bit where it's like, Dot asks Rudy.
Mm-hmm.
Dot's like, hey, Rudy, or Rudy tells this story, but is like, could you take this bottle of water and dump it on the foundation of the observatory? Uh-huh. And Rudy's like, wow, that really sounds like a horror movie kind of thing to do. And somebody's like, well, did you do it? And he's like, no, I don't want to open that gateway to hell or whatever. Uh-huh. And you're like, yeah,
well, and
good
you
job,
hear,
Rudy.
You hear the story, or Wes says, hey, Dot, I threw that water bottle at town, or that water balloon at town hall.
I don't know why that's important to you, uh-huh. but yeah.
It feels just like a prank on Chester.
Yeah, good times.
From Taylor, how did you figure out the pacing of and well? I'm assuming you got a 12-episode block for each season and needed to fill it. What was your process making the story fit the way you needed to it? I'm new to podcast writing, and pacing is my biggest fear.
This is a great question.
This is a fantastic question and a very hard thing.
And a very difficult question to answer. So I figured, I thought it would be interesting to chat a little bit about, like, our process of how we, like, go from, okay, we have to fill 12 episodes, what do we put in them, to actually, like, having 12 scripts. Because I think this will kind of start to get towards the answer. But also, I also want to start by saying that, like, there isn't a right answer. Like, if Taylor is asking, like, how do I get good at this? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know that my answer is going to be the right answer for you. Because mm-hmm. if you listen to a bunch of different fiction podcasts, they are paced very differently. And our show has a slow burn quality to mm-hmm. it, and a very, like, character-driven storytelling element to it that I think sets a lot of the pacing.
Yeah.
But generally, the way that we write a season is we get our writing team together, which is six of us, the four writers, Jess, Bilal, and Jim, and then Jeffrey and I. Mm-hmm. And we get together and we do a bunch of brainstorming about things we want to see in a given season, things that weren't tied up that we want to, continue on, themes we want to see more of. It usually involves a lot of post-it notes, either on a wall or, if we're doing this remotely, like on a Google Jamboard. And then we start to fill in kind of where are the places we are, where are we now, and where do we want to get to by the end of the season? Like, what's the signposts for the beginning and the end? We also try to usually put a significant plot point in episode 6
mm-hmm.
because we do a big break between episode 6 and 7. And so we usually treat the season like it's two acts of mm-hmm. a play, let's say. And your first half, 1 through 6, have a sort of arc with a climax. And your second half, 7 through 12, have a arc with a climax.
And it's worth saying that those end up being slightly different. You know, we get to the 6th hill, and that's usually a cliffhanger that leaves us hanging up high.
Yeah.
And then we go through 7 to 11,
mm-hmm.
and we always talk about 11 being our pinnacle of the full season.
The punch.
That's things like the Celery Festival episode.
It's when they go down into the hole in the under the observatory.
And Wes finds out.
Yep. And then usually 12 has a sort of denouement quality to it, where mm-hmm. everybody goes, oh shit, what just happened? And we kind of close some thoughts and set up some thoughts for the next season.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the major signposts. But the part of this process that I always find the most amusing is there always seems to be, for this team, a point in the process where it's like, we've thrown all these post-it notes on the wall. There's all these ideas. We kind of vaguely have agreed that, like, here's what goes in episode 6. Now what? And usually what happens in that point is I take all the post-it notes and I go away somewhere else and I map the season.
Mm-hmm.
I usually go away and I, and what I'll do is I will usually take 12 pieces of, you know, 6x11, like just printer paper, and spread them out on a table and start moving the post-it notes around and go like, I think that works. And then I usually bring that back to the team and say like, and the way I usually frame it is like, here is a straw man of what I think the season should be. And then we push on it and we figure out like, what's, you know, do we actually track all the characters through it, or have we lost track of somebody for too long and we need to weave them back in? Is this too much of one thing or too much of another thing? And one of the things that I've learned from Jim that I really appreciate is Jim has a really good sense for looking at a whole season and thinking about the balance between like action set pieces and character driven episodes. Mm-hmm. And so he will often, I feel like, look at a season and go like, all right, so in this episode, something explodes, in this episode, something explodes, and then in this episode, something explodes. And somewhere in between those, we need some episodes where people just like talk to each other.
Yeah.
And we, and it gives the story a little bit of room to breathe. It gives the story a place where you hear characters react to the explosions, mm-hmm. and sort of you understand how everybody's point of view is shifting a little bit, or the relationships between people are changing based on the explosions. And like, that is a, that that's a, I feel like that's a pacing thing that like I've gotten better at over the 5 years of doing this show. And I feel like I've learned from our team, mm-hmm. how to kind of like look across the episodes and say like, you want a mix, you want, you know, some explosions and some moments where everybody goes, oh my God, can you believe that thing exploded?
Yeah. I feel like there's a really interesting thing with audio fiction specifically that is less so in a serialized format like television, where, you know, you've also got visuals, that like you need more time to, I'm going to use show, you need more time to show character growth and characters processing stuff, because you don't get seen, you know, you don't get montages or, you know, long moments where you just get to watch people going about their days, or, you know, walking up to a house and reading about even, what they're like.
Or even I feel like often in films that are very, you know, driven by emotion, a lot of that emotion comes in like the thing that is unsaid, or mm-hmm. the moment when you see someone's face change across, you know, in reaction to something, yeah. or you see, you know, there's a lot of emotion that can be driven by how you see someone react. Mm-hmm. And in audio, like they either have to say it or very notably not say it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
and so I really enjoy that in our sort of story crafting and writing process, because I think it's really interesting mm-hmm. to hear people talk about their feelings and to process things. Yeah. I think that's really compelling. And audio encourages that as a way to get your story across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, I think the one of the other tools that can be really useful for this is the, we do a full cast read, mm-hmm. where in 1 or 2 days we read the entire season with as much of the cast as we can put together. And that actually is really helpful for noticing how is the pacing going. Do we have two very similar episodes back to back or too close to each other? Are we only seeing Wes in the first half of the season and not at all in the second half of the season? Things like that.
I will say, I think we are very lucky both in that we have a writer's room where we read things out loud. Mm-hmm. And then we also have this chance to do the full cast table read.
Yeah.
And those are both chances to hear the words out loud, which gives you a much better sense of pacing than reading it on the page. And so I'm now working on a number of other audio fiction projects outside of Unwell. And I have started to really notice the difference between writers who write on their own and don't get a chance to hear their work out loud, mm-hmm. and writers who work as part of a team and get, just because there's more of you, it's easier to read it out loud.
Sure.
And yeah, I that would be one very big piece of advice, is if you're writing on your own, like, find some friends, like, yeah. bring some people together, like, find a way to hear your scripts out loud, mm-hmm. because you will learn a lot about how they work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, I'm Yusuf Dahl, and when I was 18, I was convicted of selling drugs. For the past 3 years, I've had difficulty finding housing because it is legal in the United States to discriminate against individuals that have a past drug distribution conviction on their record for life. It doesn't matter if it was a hard drug like heroin or a drug that's now legal or partially legal in many states across the country, like marijuana. The Thurman Amendment was introduced to the Fair Housing Act in 1988 by segregationist Strom Thurmond, and it's since been used to deny housing to all people. But because people of color are disproportionately jailed for drug charges, we are affected more. My goal is to overturn this amendment to start an end to housing discrimination that unfairly targets people of color. If you would like to join this movement, please visit ThurmanAmendment.org to learn more.
A message from the Fable and Folly Network.
Sarah says, I loved the fact that the voice actor for the waitress in Hunters reminds me of Nurse Diesel from High Anxiety. Good job.
Sarah, thank you so much for listening and for the great compliment. I have to confess, I've never actually seen High Anxiety. And when I saw your feedback, I went back and forth for a couple of days about whether or not I wanted to give it a listen before or after we recorded our final episodes. And ultimately, I decided I was going to give it to myself as a treat after we were finished recording, because I didn't want to adversely affect my performance by putting in a different perspective that wasn't consistent with what I had been doing before. But I also didn't want to be accidentally do it wrong and disappoint you. So thank you so much. I'm really excited about checking out the movie now.
Kyle Winchester asks, what was the inspiration for Unwell? Was there a book or film that sparked the idea to write the show? That's a great question, and there are a whole lot.
I think you and I should just pick one each.
Yes.
Because we've answered this question a lot before.
That's
and
true.
We will often go on way too long.
We do tend to ramble.
But I feel like if we each picked one, that would be fun. I think the one that's top of mind for me that I'll say is that when we started when we started working on this show, one of the things I brought to the table that is like really made it through to the end, mm-hmm. is I really, really wanted to tell a story about Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. That was really important to me. I was like there, and particularly as I was thinking about like the gothic space and horror and like what scares me, mm-hmm. and like thinking about, you know, what scares me most in this world. Memory loss and aging relatives is a thing that impacts almost all of us. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember at one point at one of our early table reads, asking the team, like, who all has someone they love who's lost their memory in old age. And I think like 90% of the room mm-hmm. raised their hands. It's a nearly universal experience. And I wanted more stories about it.
Sure.
I wanted an opportunity to try and explore some of the things that are hard about that in a fictional space, because I couldn't find stories that mm-hmm. were serving my needs elsewhere.
Oh boy. I want to talk about one of the inspirations that I mention but don't go into a lot, and that's the television show Gravity Falls.
Yes.
Wait,
can I just say?
Yeah.
So when my parents finally got Disney Plus, my dad watched Gravity Falls, and he calls me up and he goes, "This show is exactly like Unwell. Did you guys know about this show?" And I was like, "This show is one of Jeffrey's like number one influences."
Uh huh.
Huh? But my dad was like, it's like beat for beat, exactly like Unwell. And I was like, yeah, I know, Dad.
It's I found it. It's a show. It, obviously, it's way zanier and wackier, but it's a show that has a lot of really fantastic mystery. And it's also about a family that has conflict and also like deeply loves each other, and where everyone is imperfect and still tries to be there for each other, even when they screw up. And I think I was really excited both by the kind of the way it was mysterious and scary, and also it was a place that I really wanted to live and wanted to like be there and experience. I think, you know, if you're going back to watch it, it's worth saying that it has a whole bunch of gender essentialism that hasn't yeah. aged super well and is not so much reflected in Unwell, but it's a great show. It's, yeah, it's three seasons. I also liked how contained it was and how it kind of let itself feel a little too short. It feels a little bit like a summer. It's told over the course of one summer. And
So I didn't watch Gravity Falls until we were like well into writing mm-hmm. the show. I think I watched it after my dad was like, you really got to watch this show. And one of the things that Gravity Falls shares with Unwell, I feel like, is an ethos of this weird shit is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Or like there can be joy and beauty inside of the weird.
Yeah.
That even though it is kind of scary to be like, that's not how the world is supposed to work. Mm-hmm. There's also like a joy and a fun and a like, okay, but like, I want to know more. And yeah. like, I like being in this place where everything is so weird. Mm-hmm. Even though I can't explain it, and it's a little bit scary. Yeah.
Yeah. Ash asks, how did you decide on Southern Ohio as the location of Mount Absalom? And how do you feel the setting has shaped the story? That's a great question. So
Jeffrey decided.
Yeah, this was yes, I was very firm on it being Ohio. There was an alternate version of this that was very nearly set in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan that I think Jim was really in favor of, or maybe
I don't remember that.
Maybe it was Northern Minneapolis.
None of that. He made
a very strong pitch for one of the kind of further north Midwestern locations.
Then we could have had more loons.
We have been a little fast and loose with some of the animals that appear in the story. I spent a bunch of time living in central Ohio, in rural central Ohio, and so that setting was very important. And then I think we shifted it south mostly because that's where the bumper celery crops are.
Oh my God, that's right. That is why yeah. we did it. Uh-huh.
So
that's so funny. I forgot. Yeah. We like decided when we were writing season one, we knew we wanted to have a big agricultural festival mm-hmm. and we decided it was going to be celery. And then we were like, well, where do they grow celery?
Uh-huh.
Shit, we got to look that up.
Yeah. I don't remember which of the writers, one of the writers, you know, did a bunch of research and was like,
it was probably Jim.
Jim or Jess Best, I think.
Yeah.
Were like, well, I went and Googled all of the staple crops of Ohio and celery is the funniest.
Yep. Agreed.
Taylor asks, what was the character naming process like? Was it a, yeah, this is the right vibe and time period thing? Or did you look into history and meanings and such?
So when we named all our main characters, like our core cast, I remember doing this thing with the writing team where we all wrote down a bunch of names
mm-hmm.
and we like put them up on the wall and talked about them and sort of like, you know, like we had to decide what Dot and Lily's surname is and mm-hmm. things like that. It was like just lots of decisions to make. So we like threw a bunch of names on the wall and kind of just like worked through until we got to consensus.
Uh-huh.
But I'll tell you, the the thing that sticks in my brain from that is that they were gonna be named Wright. Lily and Dorothy Wright, like Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And Jess Buha's maiden name is Wright. And she pipes up and she goes, that people misunderstand that all the time. That is a homonym. You can't put that in a podcast. Yeah. It doesn't, like, people won't hear it. Like, you can't. And I was like, oh, duh. That makes perfect sense. Because, like, I think we all really enjoy the sort of, like, implications or, like, metaphors of the name Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And all the things that come with that. But then, like, she said that. And it was like, oh, throw that one out. Never mind.
Yeah.
And I think we got to Harper from there. That it was like we were trying to find something that was,
it,
like,
had a similar feeling.
Yeah, that, like, had that sort of, like, it captures something about, like a maker.
Mm-hmm.
Like a I don't know, I feel like it evokes this idea of, like, a person who can make things in the world, which I appreciate. But yeah, mostly I just remember it kind of being like, we were like, ah, oh, that's a cool name.
Uh-huh.
We like that one.
I remember Marisol happened, like, very fast.
Yes.
We're like,
yes.
That is a perfect name. We love it.
Yep. So then there's other, outside of our kind of core cast from season one, characters who get introduced later in the story or smaller characters are almost entirely determined by the writer who first introduced them.
Mm-hmm.
So most significantly is, like, Bilal named Nora.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Nora's key biographical pieces were all determined by Bilal. And a lot of the historical characters who, like, you know, family members and whatnot, were named by the writer who first introduced them.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think it's worth sharing that, like, also pretty early on, somewhere in between, I think, seasons one and seasons two writing process, Jim wrote a history of Mount Absalom starting mm-hmm. with, like, the Big Bang.
Yeah.
And so Jim, I think, deserves credit for naming a lot of the sort of branches of Dot and Lily's lineage.
Hmm.
The sort of, like, who owned the house when, and yeah. when did it change from maiden name to married name?
The Fenwood to Harper's.
Yeah. Yep. And, like, when was the house built and what was there beforehand, and, like, kind of all of that superstructure for mm-hmm. the family. I think Jim deserves a lot of credit for that.
Yeah.
But, like, Josephine versus Caroline, like, mm-hmm. whoever wrote that episode probably just made it up.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to see if I can remember any, like, other names that almost were and got switched.
I mean, I think the other thing I remember kind of trying to pull on was, like, choosing names in some places that evoked generation
mm-hmm.
or, like, age. Like, Hazel is a name that I think is meant to imply something about how old she is.
Mm-hmm. Dorothy definitely is.
Dorothy is definitely a name that we chose to try and imply something about her age.
I'm also trying to remember whether Wes or the Theodore Wesley reveal came first. Like, if we said this character is named Theodore Wesley, I think Wes came first.
I feel pretty confident about that.
And then we wanted to figure out a way that his name could be on a tombstone.
Yeah.
That, I mean, if we had visuals, we could show the tombstone
yeah.
and it would be less intense and less, but, like, because we had to say it out loud at some point, it had to not be directly Wes. Yeah.
Yeah, also, like, I was watching The Twilight Zone on New Year's Eve, and there's something about, like, pan to the gravestone with the name on it that's very Twilight Zone.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, our actors answered a little bit of this, but I said I would talk about it more. Shelby asks, have any of the actors improvised lines? If so, what is one of your favorite improvised lines and why?
I mean, Michael improvises all the time. It just doesn't make it into the show. Yes.
Folks, there is an entire podcast of the Wes and Abby show that Kat and Michael have improvised in during sound checks and things like that. So I want to talk a little bit about the writing and kind of how we work with the scripts and then tell a couple of improvised line stories. And part of it is that a lot of us on Unwell come from the theater world. And in theater, when you are doing a play that is not a new work, and you know, also often new works, but there is a sometimes a culture and most often a legal necessity to not change any of the writer's lines. And I love that because as a director, I feel like I get to work with the material that the writers have created. And if there's something that doesn't make sense to me, or if I'm like, that just like, it's not clicking, it means I haven't figured out something about the characters that we haven't pulled something out. And often by really strictly adhering to the script, we will find something new and exciting. Now, during the process of Unwell, we do make small changes in the recording room. We will sometimes record alternate versions of lines, you know, shift something for the flow, or, you know, when an actor feels like, you know, they're really in touch with a character, they might say, ooh, can we phrase this like this instead? Because I feel like, you know, that's how the character makes sense to me. And we'll often go with that. But I think there's something really exciting about pushing off of a really sturdy script and having it stable. That being said, we have had some amazing improvisations. The one I do want to talk about is with our young actor who plays Jamie, Miles, who is the son of one of our writers, Jess Buha. And this is just, it's one of those moments, you know, Jess and Miles and I are working through this script and Miles is working on this joke that Jamie delivers. And it's something like, it's a knock, knock joke about peanut butter. And rather than reading the line as written, he delivers the line that is actually said, which is something like knock, knock, peanut butter who? Oh, that's funny because I know a cashew named peanut butter or something like that. And I don't understand it, but it's such a pure kid joke. And it's so funny. It's so beautiful. And, you know, Jess is right there and is like, can we please read the joke as I wrote it? And I was like, yeah, we can, but
we're not going to use it,
but I just got a perfect take. So we generally do try to stick purposefully as close as we can to the script because, you know, yeah, we put a lot of really, really careful thought into it. And we've got actors who are so good at making it sound like it's the first time they've said the words. And there are lots of ways. Improvisation is one way to get there, but also I think trusting the actor's craft and knowing that they will be able to dig out this, you know, this big emotional truth with the words that they've been working with is really important.
But also like working with a 6-year-old. Come on. That kid's too clever. Too clever by half. This question comes from Taylor with an exclamation point. Taylor, do you have a favorite setting to write about? The personalities of Wes's house, the observatory, and Fenwood are all very different. Do you have a location whose personality you most enjoy exploring? Man, it's interesting because I like them all. I don't have a good answer for this question. I feel like our listeners have really tapped into the idea of like Fenwood as a house being its own complex character.
Mm-hmm.
I love that about the show. I love, it's one of my favorite things about this show, seeing writers write that personality on the page mm-hmm. and then hearing it come to life in the show is like so much fun.
Well, and the different writers write the house
a little bit differently.
And it's really interesting. And each designer uses the house a little differently.
Yep, yep. So that's always, I think, going to be my fallback position of mm-hmm. a favorite because it's so central to the story.
Yeah, it's the most fully developed and we've got so many interesting tools there.
Yeah. There, I mean, I will also say there is a reason that we keep going back to Hunter's Diner.
Yeah.
Like that first Hunter's Diner episode, I thought was a one-off.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we have gone back over and over and over again is really a testament to how compelling of a place it is.
Yeah.
And the personality of it capturing something that like we didn't know we needed, mm-hmm. I think, at first. That has been a delightful surprise of a location that mm-hmm.
Let's see. Thinking of it more as a director and a designer, as a designer, I love the kitchen. I love spending time in the kitchen because there's so, like, I love the cat clock.
Oh.
I love how much you can do with that as a kind of way of indicating time and silence and anxiety. I love all of the different things that you can touch and drawers you can open and fridges and things like that that you can, like, work with in a kitchen, and the Fenwood kitchen is a really great example of that. I love getting designed for Hunters. It's weird and scary and fun.
And like moist.
Mm-hmm.
In these ways that are like really weird.
Yeah. That first description of the shag carpet that squishes when you walk on it. Just the worst.
That came right out of a script.
Oh. I tell you, as a designer, I found the observatory to be actually a surprisingly difficult one.
Yeah.
Because it is a big open space without lots of things you can touch to indicate where you are. And as you go under the observatory, you know, you are going from a big open space with lots of reflective surfaces to a slightly smaller big empty space in the basement, and then another big empty space that is maybe a little bit less reflective but more haunted in the chapel below. And so it's just like, I feel like it's really hard to make sure you're making each of those a really distinctive thing. And, you know, originally I was thinking, oh, it'll be really easy because in the observatory we'll have lots of beeps and boops and things like that. And I was like, no, we won't. Like, none of the equipment is on when any of these people are like knocking around focusing the telescope. Like,
also, like, computers just don't actually make that much noise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, yeah. Like, a room full of computers is like pretty quiet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. But I don't know, I love the observatory, basement, chapel kind of stack.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I love any setting where you can kind of break into an area below and then go into something even when there are like layers of descent you can do. And so the chapel has been a really fun thing to play with in that.
Yeah, totally.
All right. Well, that is what we have time for today. Thank you all so, so much for sending in these great questions. It was really fun to get to dive in and think about this show and try to answer some of these. We are currently working on bringing you season 5. We are so, so excited for you to hear it. So keep your ears peeled for an announcement soon on when that will be dropping. And until then, have a great day. thing that was really exciting for me was that I got to, ow, sorry, sharp
that
kitten.
Cat.
The Fable and Folly Network, where fiction producers flourish.
This season on Civilized. Or not, it's improvised, so you don't know.
Barty, please, no!
It has to be done for the good of the children.
Captain, is it Beatrix or Beatrice? I'm so confused.
I'll tell you who it is. It's your mother.
I have summited the mountain, and I declare this land for my own.
Barty, get down from the roof!
Every time.
I can't believe we made it into space, Beatrice!
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, Al. Wait, which version are you?
Which version are you?
So you're saying we've been on Earth the whole time?
Yeah, man, it's like just a simulation.
Actually, we've been dead the whole time.
Actually, this is Lost.
Actually, I'm lost.
We only have 5 seconds to defuse this bomb.
When you started saying that, or at the end of saying that?
Sound of explosion.
So join us on Civilized Season 5 for this stuff that might happen, but probably a lot of it won't. Regardless, we're back with your favorite characters doing zany things in space, and we couldn't be more pumped. We'll see you soon, listeners.
Civilized Season 5 begins May 31st, 2023. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts or visit civilizedpod.com.
Because usually they're pretty normal.
Yeah.